I'm Nick Zeppos, Chancellor of Vanderbilt University. Welcome to the Zeppos Report, a podcast where I talk with the people shaping and helping us understand our world. My guest today is Jelani Cobb, Ira A. Lippman Professor of Journalism at Columbia University and staff writer for The New Yorker. He is a leading American contemporary voice on the topic of racial justice and its interactions with politics, history, and culture. And I would say I read him religiously. In 2004, Dr. Cobb won the Sidney Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism. Jelani is visiting Vanderbilt today to address our campus community on a wide range of issues, but particularly on the intersection of race and sports. He is joining me in my office beforehand to get the conversation started. Jelani, welcome to the Zeppos Report.
Thank you.
We've been talking about a lot of different things, and you know, it's just, first of all, a privilege to have you here.
Thank you.
And to, you know, be part of hearing your real voice that, as I said, I read religiously. And, you know, we were talking about this kind of sense of civic participation, this project called, you know, We the People. And you said you thought that President Obama in his 2004 speech at the convention, and, you know, in many ways, maybe his speech in March of 2008, I believe, is a similar sort of reckoning and a similar sort of speech. And you said, well, other people have tried to do that. Mm-hmm. Who else do you think really has tried to do that?
Oh, I mean, that's the kind of, at various critical junctures, you know, in American history, people have tried to, with some success, in some instances, kind of appeal to this broader sense of Americanness. I mean, really, when you think about what Lincoln and Douglas were debating, yeah, you know, it was about this very question. The House Divided speech that Lincoln gives, where he's talking about the country has to kind of all be one thing or another, the beginning of the country, which I'm actually going to talk about a little bit later, where there's this idea of Republican virtue and people are trying to craft a sense of Americanness as opposed to having a sense of colonial identity with England as the common referent. So I think that happens. I mean, FDR, you know, particularly in the midst of World War II. And, you know, in some instances, this actually does work. If you're looking at the kind of esprit de corps that the people have, you know, around, you know, the attack from Japan and the kind of all-encompassing villainy of Nazi Germany, then you can kind of carve out this national narrative. Yeah. And I don't mean that this papers over all these divisions.
No, no, no. It's kind of like I think.
I mean that it is something that people can reference commonly, and it has some sort of appeal. Whether or not it's by necessity a political undertaking, whether or not it's actually historically accurate is something else.
Yeah. Well, I think it's. I think the reference to Nazism in World War II is interesting because it's like, okay, we fight the war, and you know, it is about this racial identity that and this racial ideology that is exterminating people and Jews and gypsies and intellectuals and
people with disabilities.
And we come back and it's like, you know, it's kind of like, okay, what is the American project? And I think that's where there's kind of that disconnect, which is, okay, we all fought this war for freedom and repudiation of racist ideology taken to its most extreme extermination. But yet we know the reality is then Brown against Board is resisted and Truman is criticized for integrating the armed forces. I think our when I hear students asking tough questions, you know, they ask Michael Eric Dyson about, we're talking about this, and they asked him the other night too. It's like, well, what about all the bad stuff? I mean, and one has to do a reckoning with that. I think the interesting thing for me is can one extract principles of virtue and love and equality and say these are imperfectly and often denied repeatedly in America, but yet they are a common project that is worth taking on. And they're almost human rights. It's just basic natural rights that we ought not give up, even in the face of resistance and failure by our own body politic.
But the problem is that you have to be willing to confront that, actually.
Yes.
Like the narrative, as long as you're not willing to confront those shortcomings, the narrative is completely invalid. And as opposed to being imperfect, you then become hypocritical.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to say, like, the idea of kind of American exceptionalism, which has hindered the United States in more ways than it has ever helped it, if you establish yourself and identify yourself as exceptional, it has a kind of rear guard rationalization element of it, that everything else that you did must have all been for the greater good because look at how you've turned out. But the fact of the matter is that none of the progress that's happened in this country has been inevitable. It has happened on the tide of struggles that were set back many times before they succeeded. People who organized for their entire lives but never saw victory. People who tried to abolish slavery for decades before the Civil War actually achieves that, or labor rights, or the right to vote for women, or any of the protections that we have, you know, for the Americans with Disabilities Act. Anything that's made the country more humane and more exemplary has happened in fits and starts. And when we paper over it as if there's this kind of linear progress narrative, in order for us to maintain a sense of ourselves as, if not unblemished, then mostly unblemished, less certainly less blemished than any other state, nation state that exists. And if we proceed from that place, then we become blinded to the pitfalls that all of those movements encountered previously. So it's an uncomfortable idea to think that Nazism had a fairly significant amount of support in the United States. Or that, you know, Fritz Kuhn or the American Firsters, you know, the German-American Bund, and which, you know,
in those,
Madison Square Garden, right, with 20,000 people there cheering wildly, or the ways in which Hitler praised American Jim Crow laws and said that and the idea of maintaining racial purity, the only country in the world that understood what it was doing was the United States. Things that we would currently think of as shameful parts of American history. But I think that it winds up being, you know, the joke I always make about it is that being exceptional is like being rich or being good looking, which is that it's better for, much better for other people to say that about you than it is for you to say that about yourself.
Yeah, well, I think the, I think coming to reckoning and, you know, giving an account that's more inclusive and more, you know, kind of less designed to create an answer to the question of what you want to say our narrative is, rather than letting people participate and study and tell the narrative, is a very, very difficult thing. You see it on college campuses where, you know, you have a Calhoun College you know, it's kind of like, you know, we had a Confederate, you know, Confederate Memorial Hall. And, you know, it's like, well, are we coming to terms at every level? And if we don't do that, then I think you're right. It really is, it is hypocritical. I believe universities as places of learning are really, you know, the most likely and the most qualified and the most responsible for saying, you know, hey, I mean, Georgetown University sold slaves, or this building was built to honor and give an account of the Confederacy and educate teachers that was going to tell an account of perhaps lost cause history. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, a lot of people disagree with me. That's not an ideological account. Mm-hmm. It's an historical account of what was done as part of a project to capture the history and memory of what we call America or the Civil War.
Right. And proudly so. Like when you kind of go back to examine the actual documents and actual doctrines of the Confederacy, they aren't nearly as shy about saying what their causes mm-hmm. are. And it's very interesting that we hear this narrative in which people denounce political correctness, but what we have is the most politically correct version of the Confederacy imaginable, that we've airbrushed out all the ugly parts and it becomes a more streamlined version of the history. You wind up finding yourself in these absurd extremes. Like last summer in New Orleans, when Mayor Mitch Landrieu wanted to remove those four monuments, Confederate or Confederate theme monuments, and the monument to the Battle of Liberty Place, which was, you know, essentially a race riot to remove the interracial police force of New Orleans. And this battle is memorialized by this obelisk. And, you know, the defenders come out and say that this is about Southern pride, not about racism. But the obelisk has a dedication to white supremacy at the basis of, at the base of it. Literally says white supremacy. Yeah. And so that became the most convenient metaphor for understanding the way this entire history has been handed down to us. And so can you be exceptional without being willing to grapple with the ugly implications of having fought the bloodiest war in American history and fought really to your last man for the right to own other people? Mm-hmm. You know, well, it's more exceptional to acknowledge that and say that this is a tragic shortcoming of our understanding of humanity and something that we've learned from than it is to disavow that this had ever been the motivation in the first place.
Yeah, I think kind of coming to terms is, and telling the history, we've certainly thought about that. I've described to you a movie we've made about Perry Wallace, who just passed. Mm-hmm. And he came to Vanderbilt, and he was valedictorian of his high school and went to Pearl High School, and he admitted to the engineering school as a valedictorian. He was also a great basketball player, and he came to play basketball in the SEC and first athlete really to play a season and graduate as an African-American student athlete in the SEC, mm-hmm. went on to Columbia Law School, became mm-hmm. a law professor, thought, well, I could maybe get some money, and maybe the ABA was around at the mm-hmm. time, a little competition. And he said, no, I'm going to be a lawyer and a distinguished law professor. One thing I was really struck by was that when I came to Vanderbilt, then even as I started working more in this building, how much antagonism there still was toward his kind of last interview, mm-hmm. which was, this was really hard. Mm-hmm. And people weren't always great to me.
Right.
And I probably wouldn't do this again. Mm-hmm. And it was a big backlash. And finally, I think there was an effort, which continues to give more honest accounting of Vanderbilt mm-hmm. and our story about this. And he, in the most loving way, said, well, I want to reconcile. Mm-hmm. And he had his jersey retired, and he came back and spent a lot of time. But it was very interesting how he spoke to the current students and his classmates. And there was a lot of appreciation. It was like, wow, this guy's a hero. And I think what always strikes me is when I watched and learned about the movie and read the book that was on the bestsellers list, I had not many people that would have said that about him back then.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be honest about that,
mm-hmm.
that we can't say, wow, look at, we broke the color barrier and, you know, I'm Branch Rickey or something like that. You know, we have to say there are a lot of people in our own community, on our own right. board of trust,
right.
that really not only didn't want him here, thought that, you know, he was causing trouble. I mean, the, you know, and so you can call someone a hero, you can call someone a pioneer, but, you know, it's not like people were saying that about
no.
Martin Luther King or Frederick Douglass.
Or Rosa Parks. Right?
Yeah, Rosa Parks. I mean, King, these people are...
The year before King died, it was a public opinion poll that showed that two-thirds of the white public had negative opinions of him. And this was across Northerners and Southerners.
Yeah.
And so, especially when he began doing things like protesting residential segregation yeah. in the North, and notably in Chicago and yeah. the suburbs, outlying areas. So, yeah.
Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War.
Income inequality.
People accused Rosa Parks of being a communist.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Jackie Robinson, when he died in his 50s, and his widow, Rachel Robinson, said that she thought that the stress of integrating baseball had taken years off of his life.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's, again, these kind of uncomplicated narratives that we have to have, and kind of pre-masticated, easily digestible, you know, feel-good version of what we call American history.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about sports. You've written so much about it. Obviously, you'll talk more about it tonight. We recently announced a new Center for Sports and Society here at Vanderbilt. Why does sports so move the consciousness and conscience of America, in your view?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure that it always does. I mean, it does. It's a reflection, certainly. But it doesn't always move, and certainly not in the ways that we think of it. You know, so when we look at something like Jack Johnson, you know,
yeah.
winning the heavyweight title in 1908, and, you know, there are race riots
yeah.
you know, as a
yeah.
result of that.
Yeah.
And people didn't look at that as, you know, here's this moment of achievement.
Yeah.
They looked at it more with a kind of expression of doomsaying
yeah.
that, you know, this is a terrible thing. If yeah. you know, know the history of this, that they stopped the fight reels so that you would never actually get to see him knock out, I think it was, is it Jacobs or Jeffries that he wins the title from? But
yeah.
you never actually see that. There's no historical record of it because, you know, it was deemed to be too volatile right. a thing to impose, to inflict upon the delicate psyche of the American public.
Yeah.
And then in other regards, you know, you kind of do have those moments that would seem to transcend, certainly in sports. There's a higher likelihood of people from different backgrounds interacting and engaging with each other, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different racial backgrounds. Now, what the implications of that are, I think, is probably a much more complicated story.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about college basketball, if we're talking about the NFL,
right.
you know, there's a certain set of socioeconomic relationships that complicate this. But I do think on a basic level, because of the market share that sports has in American life, or that sports have in American life, it's allowed people to have conversations and engage in ways that they might not otherwise.
Yeah. Was the Colin Kaepernick treatment and continuing debate and continuing, you know, controversy, did it surprise you at all?
No.
And why not?
So it's almost predictable that we'll, when we're kind of confronted with uncomfortable things, we fall back to established habits or uncomfortable conversations. And so rather than have the conversation around policing, which is what prompted Mr. Kaepernick to take a knee, Instead, we had a conversation about whether or not you, quote unquote, respect the troops. And, well, okay, but this is not, you know, this kind of protection and zeal that we have for the troops is of a piece different than what we're talking about for people who don't have an equal share in American democracy. And what I mean by that is this. We've traditionally seen, the military or military conflict or these moments where we're supposed to unite the country around particular causes. Maybe we'd say now this is, you know, the war on terror or whatever it is that is the kind of unifying banner of American military, you know, behavior at this moment. And that's supposed to be the thing that holds us together. We saw that in World War I. We saw that in World War II. Not so much in Vietnam, but that's been the kind of idea. And to impose this reality or this truth that we don't all have a equal proximity to freedom in this country is uncomfortable. And so we avert it and start having this other conversation. The same sort of thing. And I also, you know, wrote about the way that people called Colin Kaepernick ungrateful, which was it was a very weird thing to me. It was not unexpected, but it was still weird because it presumes that a person who, has had, good fortune economically has given up their right to be critical about anything else that falls short in this country.
Yeah, there are a lot of people with affluence and visibility who seem like they think it's fine for them to get up and talk about politics.
There's a person in the White House who feels that way.
I don't want to get you in trouble. No. I'm a free speech person here, and I think that for someone to protest really doesn't, I mean, to me, have much to do with you got a lot of money for something. Why are you complaining? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you feel like something's wrong, and it's to me very obviously racialized, and if somebody really wants to criticize somebody or America in some way, and I might disagree, I might say that's wrong, but yet I don't think, I just think that those are, I don't want to call them coded words. They're, active. Mm-hmm. Hostile words to say, well, you, and it happened to Perry. It's like, well, you got a scholarship, we'll let you live in our dorms. It's like,
be quiet.
Okay.
Now, right.
I mean, it's kind of like, well, that's what everyone else, that's, why aren't you asking everyone else to be quiet? I mean,
right.
Yeah. And so I think that, I think, if someone wants to protest and, Lord knows, I mean, people have many, many different ways of protesting. I wrote a little essay one time about how it was during World War II that the Jehovah's Witnesses refused to salute the flag.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because the court originally said they got to salute the flag. You know, this is America. And in the middle of the war, they reversed that decision. And, that might make a lot of people uncomfortable that in, 1943, a group of people said, you know what, we may be at war, but in my heart, I can't in good conscience. Now, that was a religious case, but our beliefs about justice to me are, those are natural law principles that at least Thomas Jefferson and many other people told us come from our Creator. And so I think it's odd that in the middle of World War II, these people, are just saying, we're not going to salute the flag. And we say, well, that's American liberty, and I'm sure it was very uncomfortable for them, but it's just amazing to me. Mark Twain said history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Mm-hmm. And, just people not understanding that James Baldwin said, I don't hate America. I love America. That's why I'm criticizing
it. Right. That's why you criticize it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean,
to strip that patriotism out, it's like, no, I love this country. I just want to make it better.
Is the most simplified version of patriotism.
Yes.
Which is has no place for dissent.
Yeah.
But it's also worth noting that, the First Amendment provides us with free speech. I mean, literally the First Amendment provides us with free speech.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at the top of the list of, you know, these enumerated rights is our ability to criticize, you know, the people who hold power over us. And given how paranoid, you know, the founders were, and, you know, especially the way that, that Madison wrote exquisitely about trying to strike that balance between having enough power to govern and not enough power to rule, you know, there is a kind of clear through line saying the first thing that we can do to prevent ourselves from becoming the tyrants that we're trying to separate ourselves from is to empower people to criticize us, to tell us when we're doing something wrong. And that seems to have been completely erased from our modern conception, not completely, but very largely erased from our modern conception of what we mean by patriotism.
Yeah. I read your recent essay. I'm going to shift gears here a little bit, but just giving me a little bit of, I guess, free university advice. I read your a really brilliant essay about Howard.
Oh.
And I really have to tell you that I commend it to everybody as a deeply textured, nuanced, really insightful account of that university, and I think insights into the role of HBCUs that I think a lot of people need to pay more attention to. But one thing that you know, I feel as a professor, and you know, I'm a lawyer, I'm a law professor. I understand my students are going to go to lawyers, be lawyers for the most part, and but yet I worry that we on campuses are being hit what I call the new vocationalism. And that when we talk about education and lifting ourselves up, we say, okay, well, why does someone need to study art history? Why does someone need to memorize, you know, Shakespeare? Why does someone need to read Ralph Ellison? I mean, they need skills to do X. And I've just been, and I think your essay talks about this, just how central it was to Howard and other schools and other leaders and educators and Du Bois to say, no, we are going to study the fundamental basis of how we are going to be full active citizens in a free society. Do you think we still have this debate about, well, that's all great, you could go study this, but you need to go to technical school? What, I mean, what is the role of a liberal arts education at a Howard, at a Morehouse, at a Fisk, at a Vanderbilt in a democratic society when people are saying you can't do anything with that?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting observation. And so initially those questions were being hashed out around the issues of segregation and you know, what should education do for a largely subordinate population? And you know, Booker T. Washington, of course, kind of ridiculed the idea of you know, someone who you know, lives in an impoverished community but they're reading Chaucer, and so or learning to speak French, and so, and Du Bois, of course, and we're just kind of using these as rough proxies.
Right.
Lots of other people who are in these debates, but Du Bois thought that it was crucial for people to have broader kinds of educational access, and that that would in turn allow them to kind of wedge the door of opportunity open. But that debate kind of mirrors a much broader debate now, and I think that part of this is, of course, the cost of higher education, that people are thinking about this much more transactionally than they once did, and it's given, you know, rise to the consumer model of education, which, of course, professors lament to no end, because you know, students feel that if they are paying a certain amount of money, you know, per semester, then they are effectively purchasing good grades that will allow them to then move on to exactly. And I think, you know, faculty are increasingly kind of having to reiterate, it's like, no, what it actually does is purchase the opportunity for you to earn, you know, good grades. But I think that that's you know, connected to this socioeconomic dynamic that we're looking at now. On the other side of this, you know, of course, STEM is important, and we're looking at, you know, economic innovations and, you know, developments and, you know, what American infrastructure will look like and the technology economy and, you know, all those things are great. But, you know, we've seen time and time and time again that technology, absent a refined understanding of human beings, winds up leading to disastrous outcomes. If we were to look at Twitter, and, you know, when Twitter first emerged, they were, they referred to themselves as the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party. They were completely unregulated. But people who are sociologists, people who are, you know, historians, people who are psychologists, organizational psychologists, could have told them what would have happen. That you would wind up having mobs and fracture along the lines of the convenient or recognizable fault lines in society. So we see a great deal of racism and a great deal of misogyny, a great deal of anti-immigrant and religious bigotry, and all these dynamics which have come to the fore on this platform. And so now they have, you know, had to take steps to, you know, prevent people from trolling or find ways that you can block people and so on. And so just simply saying that we have the technology to create this platform outside all these other ways of kind of understanding human beings and, you know, who we are in these complex and contradictory ways, it doesn't work for us. And so I think that at some point we'll get back to a better place of understanding that these two things have to go together. And then even I think, you know, when we talk about Steve Jobs, who, you know, studied all sorts of things that you wouldn't think were worthwhile at Reed College. He's studying calligraphy and typeface and Buddhism and all these other kinds of things. And he puts it together into this you know, amalgam of a vision that winds up creating Apple. And so we have, I think we've been kind of shuttled into this series of false choices, you know, or false binaries that is, it's either this or that, and that this doesn't have any kind of, this being, you know, humanities and liberal arts doesn't have any broader application or value in society.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And, you know, I it's fascinating when we've done small groups with our board, with our students, with our faculty, and you say, okay, what are the five things that you want a student to leave Vanderbilt with for life? It's really quite remarkable that you don't hear, well, they need to know accounting so they can get a job, or they need a job right away. It's, you know, communicating, working in a diverse community, being able to have a lifelong curiosity about knowledge and change. I mean, it's the very attributes that you would want in a colleague as you know the world is going to change around you. And I worry very much that there's a, well, you're not quite ready to do the liberal arts, so you're going to do a generation of this, and then you can then next generation come over. And there's got to be a ladder for everyone, don't get me wrong, but I do, I'm very, very convinced that a deep immersion in liberal arts and STEM fields is central to your future and each student's future, but our democracy. What advice do you have for promoting free speech and civil discourse on a college campus? Is it, you know, possible? I mean, we do our best job here. You see what's going on. I think some days I tell the media, you should just come. Nothing happened today. I mean, actually, we had someone speak, and, you know, the kids were stressed with organic chemistry. I mean, it's and I don't mean to diminish the seriousness of things, but yet, what is your insight on that? And how do you, you know, kind of educate me and my students about that, Jelani?
I mean, I think it's interesting. So, I increasingly find myself in a position that on, you know, these issues on campuses that irritates everyone. And so
I think you could, you know, you'd be good at my job.
Right, right.
Irritate everybody.
Leave the room and everyone disagrees with you, then actually you're starting to make progress.
Yeah.
But I do think that we've seen a number of instances where, you know, there have been high-profile and controversial figures, some of them connected to the alt-right, so-called alt-right, and, you know, various other political movements that have been brought to campuses on under the banner of free speech. And, you know, this happened on, you know, my home campus at Columbia. Yeah. It happened recently at the University of Connecticut where, you know, a speaker actually attacked a female student. Male speaker attacked a female student, and so we've seen these kinds of volatile situations. And one of the things I don't buy is that, you know, these are people being brought to campuses to illustrate the virtue of tolerance, because it's too consistent. We're not seeing flat earthers or vaccine deniers or any of the various forms of truthers that are out, conspiratorial thinkers that are out and bouncing around on the internet. We're not seeing those people brought to campus in significant numbers, but a fairly, you know, retrograde and rabid form of white nationalism built in, based in racism and superior sense of white superiority. And so at some point I'm going to raise a skeptical eyebrow. And for students who are saying that these are people who should not be speaking on their college campuses, I think they have a leg to stand on, in the sense that scholarly journals, for instance, exist for the same reasons that universities do, to foster debate, to spread information, to kind of have a public storehouse of knowledge, you know, for, you know, a particular subject matter. But we don't allow crackpots to write in the Journal of American History or in Lancet or any of the kind of prestigious journals that the Harvard Law Review. They don't pop up there because we do believe that there is a kind of minimum standard. We're saying that, you know, we don't invite phrenologists to contribute to psychology journals or any of the other kinds of ideas that we've discarded.
I think it's very insightful, and I.
But wait. Here's the part. That's the other part. Here's where I alienate those people, though.
Yeah.
I think that they have a leg to stand on. At the same time, I think it's important to recognize that the presence of ideas that you disagree with, even if you disagree with them vehemently, is not the same thing as violence. And the idea that saying someone should not be allowed to speak on a college campus, well, there may be circumstances where that is applicable. I think those circumstances are few and far between.
Yeah.
Like, and it's specifically related to something that people can point to as saying that this person presents a danger to the campus.
And many of the public universities have had large security costs.
That's right.
Yeah. I generally believe that, you know, it's very important, and I think faculty, and, you know, faculty will disagree on everything, but faculty across the spectrum want students to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable to hear about the Middle Passage.
Right.
And I mean, it's uncomfortable to read the transcript in a death penalty case.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable to have someone talk about minimum incarceration. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's.
I show lynching images in my classes. Yeah, that's not supposed to be a fun experience.
Well, there's that photo. Yeah. I mean, there are photos that faculty use. That is not. I think your article on in the protest at Howard, when. The Attorney General spoke to the
Comey,
daughters.
Yeah.
And there they are with the nooses protesting across the street. And I remember the president saying, you know, I'm not going to tell them what to think, and I'm not going to tell them what to read.
Yeah.
But I think that has a corresponding obligation that we're going to make you read stuff
It does.
That, you know, May Native Son is not always easy to read.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's hard for us. I also think how many places where you're really going to say, well, this really makes me uncomfortable, and there's someone I can talk to mm-hmm. in a reasoned debate about it.
Right.
And I just say, boy, you know, we're pretty unusual. We got a lot of we have beautiful diversity with different mm-hmm. viewpoints. And so if you're really upset about it, why don't you talk to somebody and learn, or we'll debate about it, because that's the rare privilege that we have. I mean, right. It's just, I mean, I tell people, I said, listen, there's nowhere other than Southwest Airlines in an American college campus where we're going to mix people anymore.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so
where's Airlines? I don't know.
Well, but it's just, right. You get on there, it's like, okay, this is all right. There are a lot of different looking people.
Right, here. Right.
But then you go to your own restaurant, your own neighborhood, your yeah. own club, your own this and your own yeah. that. And it's like, you come here and it's like, okay, this is where we're all from.
Right.
And this isn't like the flight's over in 2 hours. Mm-hmm. This is full immersion into a humane experience mm-hmm. on complex, difficult issues on which you'll all have different views. And maybe you'll come to some understanding about how a society debates and reflects upon them.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, and to your point, in terms of the idea of debate, I give these students an analogy, which is that, you know, when I was a teenager, I used to hang around these boxing gyms.
Yeah.
And I started kind of boxing and, you know, was learning how to throw punches. And, you know, they put you on the heavy bag and, you know, you practice, God. You know, practice left hooks, practice jabs, you know, yeah. practice, you're kind of learning the palate, you know, of punches that you have to know. And I'm getting pretty good. And, you know, I think I'm skilled. And then comes time for me to spar. And, you know, I sparred against a guy who was smaller than me, but really quick. And I kept seeing his hand move backward for some reason. And then I realized that he was hitting me in the face, and his hands were so quick that I was only seeing them when they came back. And so the point of it was, I came to a realization that this is much harder when someone's punching back at you.
Yeah.
That is a difference between the heavy bag and actually sparring.
Yeah.
And what happens is that we get into these environments where we're in a kind of agreement abyss.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We all agree on the same yeah. things, or on 94% of things, and the other, you know, things we just don't talk about, or we demur. And when we get engaged with someone else who actually has a different point of view, we have a false sense of our own dexterity, intellectual yeah. dexterity.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think, you know, I kind of hope for my students that when they leave, that, like you say, they've got the intellectual firepower, dexterity, sense of place and mind to engage in a debate with somebody who disagrees and may be pretty thoughtful. Or I say to my law students, and might be your boss.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've gotta, you know, kind of get ready to get in the ring where the hands come back. Well, let me just finish with this last question. You've got so many. Like I said, I read everything you write. What's kind of on the horizon? What are you working on?
Oh, I'm working on now a story about William Barber, who is a pastor and organizer who is deeply involved in something called the Poor People's Campaign, and to an effort to reignite the kind of cross-racial populist coalition that Dr. King was working on at the time of his death. And while we've seen populism in its various iterations as divisive, nativist, racist, xenophobic, we are now looking at this attempt to build something that's other than that. So I'm very intrigued by that, and I've been following him around and working on a profile.
And from where's he based? And tell us.
Oh, he's based in North Carolina.
North Carolina,
but he has a travel schedule that is
oh, yeah.
punishing. They're probably professional sports franchises that are not on the road as much as he is.
I think it's an interesting time. I'm not an American historian or certainly not qualified to talk about populism, but I think your project is really interesting, and I look forward to reading it because, you know, when you think about, you know, the populist era and the progressives and then the kind of subsuming of them, and but then the resistance to populism, and we live in interesting where it's almost interesting time, which is who owns populism. I mean, it's really up for grabs.
It is,
and I think it sounds like
and has been
Reverend Barber's project is very much, and it's always been up for grabs in the sense of I think even you know that's what FDR kind of discovered. It's like okay, you know, I'm populist about this, but maybe not about this.
Right.
And, you know, my wife Eleanor is more popular about populist about this, but I'm not going there. And so I do think, but it's interesting to have such a unified government around populism when the argument is who's really a populist?
Yeah.
Who's really, what is populism and where is that coalition? And,
Well, that was once a kind of academic question that historians would debate, but that is now a kind of bitterly crucial question.
Oh, it's central.
That has like huge implications for, you know, where we go as a society, not just in the next decade or 25 years, but really in the next year and 18 months.
Yeah, I was going to say in the next year,
yeah.
I think it's going to be very, very interesting to listen to the political discourse and say, okay, these are the three things that most people care about, and this is what I'm going to do to respond to this. And so what do you think the piece will come up before the elections?
Oh, yeah, you can poll well before then.
Okay, well, I look forward to reading it. Jelani, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to address our community about so many important parts of our national and in many ways international conversation. It's an honor to host you here at Vanderbilt. You can download this and other episodes of the Zeppos Report at vu.edu/Zeppos-report, vu.edu/Zeppos-report. Thank you.
Thank you.